Welcome to 1001 True Stories. My name is Brian Tremblay, your host. Thank you for joining me. They say everyone has a story, but is it a story that could have ended badly? Did you have an incident in your life when you thought you just weren't going to make it out of the situation you were in? Did you have an encounter with someone or something that no one would have believed happened to you? That's what happened to many of my guests. Today's show, my guest is Robin Bartlett. He was a first lieutenant in the Air Mobile 1st Cavalry Division in Vietnam. Robin recalls a tale from his book from the chapter, My First Worst Day in Vietnam. After sending out a patrol at night, he heard rifle fire. What happened stayed with him for the rest of his life. Good day, folks, and welcome to the program. I have a really special guest for you today, and I'm going to let this gentleman introduce himself and tell you a little bit about his background, and then we're going to get on to some interesting story. And take it away.
Hi, my name's Robin Bartlett, and I'm a Vietnam veteran. I was in Vietnam from 1968 to 69, which was the height of the Vietnam War. I'm a graduate, college graduate, went through the ROTC program. And after commissioning and getting my degree on the same day, I had volunteered to go airborne and infantry as my branch, was assigned to the 82nd Airborne Division, spent about 4 months at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, then down to Fort Benning, and went through training, airborne training, paratrooper training, and basic infantry training and ranger school. Then back to the 82nd for another 6 months, and then received orders transferring me to Vietnam.
Wow. And
originally on orders to the 101st Airborne Division. They wanted to keep airborne officers in airborne units, but it was just after the Tet Offensive of 1968.
Yes.
And all officer orders were canceled, and I was reassigned to the 1st Air Cav Division.
1st Air Cav. My father-in-law was in that unit in Korea. When I saw your picture, I saw your picture with the crest, and then I remember seeing a picture of him in some bar in Korea with his yellow shield on there. So there you go. Continue on, sir.
Biggest patch in the Army.
Yeah, no kidding, eh? So tell us what you, I guess maybe the best story that you have that will encapsulate what it was, what kind of harrowing experiences you had in Vietnam.
So I've written a book entitled Vietnam Combat, Firefights, and Writing History. And this story comes actually as the first chapter in the book. And the title of that chapter is My First Worst Day in Vietnam.
Oh, boy. And
as I mentioned, I was assigned to the 1st Cavalry Division. And that division is famous for being the very first Air Mobile Division. And the Air Mobile concept simply was to bring fresh troops to the fighting force by helicopter, as mm-hmm. opposed to on the ground. So we made numerous combat helicopter combat assaults called Charlie Alphas.
Okay.
And after making my way to my platoon, I was assigned as the first platoon leader, A Company, 1st Battalion, 5th Cavalry Regiment. And our area of operation was primarily in the jungles around the Laotian border. Okay. So it was mountainous, three canopy jungle, three layers of growth over your head. That's what three canopy jungle is.
Wow.
So my story is the first worst day in Vietnam. And as a platoon leader, when we got replacements in, new guys, we called them FNGs.
Mm-hmm.
FNG stands for F and New Guy.
Yep, that's the one.
We watched them very, very closely for about 30 days, made sure they got acclimatized. It was extremely hot, and everyone had difficulty making the adjustment to 105, 110 degree heat. And when you're in that three canopy jungle, it's even worse because you have intense humidity.
Yeah.
So we had to be very cautious about heat exhaustion and heat stroke. So I had a sergeant join me. He was a three striper, Sergeant E5. And he was one of the very first sergeants to come into my platoon. Most of them were PFCs and corporals. And he was gung-ho. This guy had gone through what they called instant NCO school, which was a six-month training course at Fort Benning, Georgia. And he was ready to go. He wanted to take over, be a squad leader, and he had rank, superior rank over the squad leaders in my platoon, who were for the most part E4s, spec fours.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wanted to be in charge of a squad. And I said, no, we're not going to allow you to be a squad leader until you have acclimatized, until you've learned the protocols of the way we work, and we have an opportunity to evaluate you and make sure that you're a team member as opposed to an individual. There's no room for an individual in this unit. We have to work and operate as a team. So he wasn't very happy about that. And when he first was introduced to me, he saluted me in the field. And that was verboten.
Yeah.
We wore no insignia. I was not to be called sir and never to be saluted. And I told him, make that the last salute you ever give me. If you want to call me, you call me LT or you call me 1-6. 1-6 was my call sign, 1 being the first platoon leader, 6 being the leader. So he was carrying way too much equipment. He was dressed, overly dressed, and we tried to get him to modify the amount of equipment that he was carrying, but he just refused to do that. He was kind of a hard-headed guy.
Mm.
So I said, you're just going to be a team member until I have greater confidence that you're ready to be a squad leader. So he followed the rules, and I put him in charge of the squad leader, who was the most experienced man in my platoon. And I said, get him squared away. And he did his best, but he was constantly being challenged by this sergeant who wanted to take control. And I had to speak to him several times about, learning the protocols of how the air mobile operation worked and how our platoon worked as a team. And if he couldn't adjust to that, then we're going to send him back to the rear. He could find another job someplace. So he buckled under, and our typical routine was on patrols. We were on patrols every day and ambushes every night. And on this one particular day, I was told, given the instructions by the company commander, to send out a reinforced squad and to investigate a particular area, do a patrol into a particular area, had the coordinates on the map. It was a couple of, maybe 3 kilometers out, do a circle and then come back in. And this soldier, this E5, said, it was a different squad that I had assigned to take the trip. And this soldier came up to me and said, I'd like to go along. It would be beneficial to me to be with another squad leader, another team leader, and to see how they operate. And I said, okay, you can go, but under no circumstances are you in charge or are you to take over? Do you understand that? He said he did. So the squad went out, and about an hour into the operation, we heard rifle fire.
Oh, boy.
And the company commander got on the radio, and my squad leader radioed back that we had 1 KIA.
Oh, boy.
Killed in action. So about half hour later, they carried this soldier back to me. And at that point, it became my total responsibility to take care of the body. And I asked the squad leader what happened. And he said, well, we got into sniper fire, and he stood up, hand grenade in hand, and charged the sniper with a hand grenade. Jeez. And he got shot right in the head. So, you know, this was a soldier who was gung-ho, and he wanted to get his medal, and he wanted to get his kill, which was not a healthy way, a healthy attitude to have. But I found at that point, and this became extremely difficult, this was the first time that I had to take care of a KIA. And what that entailed was, first of all, to go through the pockets of the man to make sure there was nothing in there that shouldn't be there, go through his equipment, and take one dog tag and tie it to his boot. And then my medic gave me a 3x5 card with a hole punched in the corner and a piece of string. And this was a death card. Mm-hmm. And for the first time in Vietnam, they were attempting to try to locate the scene of death for every soldier.
Oh.
So I was required to put in his name and serial number and the coordinates where he had been shot to as closely as possible on the map.
We'll return to our conversation with Robin Bartlett right after these sponsor messages. And now back to 1001 True Stories with Brian Tremblay.
Then I knew that we would be bringing in a helicopter. My men did not want to have anything to do with this. Now, maybe that was just superstition on their part, but they felt like if they hadn't been involved in this activity, maybe they'd be next. It was my job. So I filled out the card and tied that to the boot along with the dog tag. The other dog tag remained around his neck. And we knew that when the choppers came in, there'd be a lot of rotor wash. And we didn't have body bags. We had ponchos. But they were big and kind of flappy. So I had a ball of twine, and I wrapped his body in the poncho and tied it off around the head and the waist and the feet, just so it wouldn't flap around. And we brought a helicopter in that brought in, you know, more ammunition and nightly supplies. And we put his body on that chopper. So that was a tough job. It was a very, very difficult job, very personal. We stood after I had wrapped him, we stood there and said a silent prayer. Nobody knew him very well. He'd only been with us about maybe 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And it affected me tremendously.
I bet.
Unfortunately, it would not be the last time I had to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why I called it my first worst day in Vietnam.
Yeah, no kidding, eh? And is it also your responsibility to, as they say, write the letter home in that respect?
No, that was the job of the S1, the personnel officer at the battalion level. They took care of that.
Right.
We had no capability of doing something like that. It was the personnel officer's job.
Right, right. Yeah, I'm still thinking back to the World War II days where they did it by hand right then and there, didn't they? Yeah, yep. Exactly. So how did you stay for how many tours, Robin?
I had one tour, and an officer typically spent 6 to 7 months in the field. And I was in the field for 7 months. And then I rotated to a staff job. And my staff job was as the personnel officer. That's the additional specialties that I had developed when I was assigned to the 82nd Airborne Division.
Right.
And I was understudying the existing S1 because he had told me when I first came into the battalion that he would be leaving just about the same time that I would be coming out of the field. And if I survived my 6 to 7 months, they'd make me the personnel officer, the S1.
Mm-hmm.
So on my second day or third day of understudying the existing S1, he came up to me in the morning and he said, did you apply for a job at division headquarters? And I said, no. And he said, well, I've got orders here that you're to report for an interview to the 14th MHD. And I said, okay, what's the 14th MHD? And he said, I have no idea. Go get on a helicopter and go to division headquarters. So I got on a helicopter and I flew to the division headquarters, which was in Camp Evans in I Corps. And I started asking around if anybody knew where the 14th MHD was. Nobody knew. Finally, I found a soldier who said, yeah, I think it's down that road. And this is a big base camp. It's a division-sized base camp, about 12,000 men at this base camp. I think it's down that road about a mile. So I walk down the road, and I come to this tent, and a sign out front that reads 14th Military History Detachment. Our motto, you fight it, we write it. So I was interviewed by a captain who said he had gone through the personnel files of every officer in the division looking for someone who had a journalism background or literature, and my degree was in comparative literature. And he had he found three officers, and he had approached the other two, and they'd all turned down the job. And I looked around this tent, this office, and I saw fans and cots and a refrigerator with cold Coke and beer in it, a television set, and out the back, they had a shower.
Well,
I was offered the job, and I said, I accept.
And that kind of maybe was the impetus for your writing later on in life, I guess, right?
Well, to some extent, I think so. I wrote home pretty frequently, and I think my mother had a premonition that I might write a book. So she saved every letter that I wrote home.
Nice.
And in the process of actually, when I finally came to grips with writing this book, because I had a family to raise, this is after I got out of the Army. Mm-hmm. I had a family to raise. I didn't have time to sit down and write a book, but I had a job that took me on long airplane flights from coast to coast.
Okay.
And that's when I wrote the book. And
gotcha.
I would work on a chapter if it wasn't too bumpy on the flight. But the job at the 14th Military History Detachment was to attend the division briefing every night. And periodically, if there was a major battle, something that lasted 2 or 3 days with a lot of activity, the G3, that's the division level operations officer, would say, in fact, this is exactly how it happened, is the representative from the military history detachment here? And I stood up and said, yes, sir, I'm here. He said, well, I want you to fly out and interview. This was after a 3-day battle that had been pretty horrific. And the company had been, for all intents and purposes, pretty well decimated. A company of 120 men they had 80 killed and wounded.
Jeez.
So it essentially became an ineffective fighting force and had to be brought back to the rear and re-equipped and with new recruits. And so I flew out and tried to interview the battalion commander, the S3, the operations officer at the battalion. They wouldn't talk to me at all. And the only person that would talk to me was the company commander, a captain. Now, he'd lost his platoon leaders and all of his platoon sergeants. They were all dead. And I had a sergeant with me and this was part of the role that we took pictures, we interviewed the people, and we tried to piece together what had happened. Because often these battles, and this one in particular, all occurred at night. And nobody really can figure out what's going on at night. It's very, very difficult.
Yeah, I bet.
And so I spent about 2 hours interviewing this captain, and he was a broken man. There was no question about it. But he said the biggest thing that challenge that he had was that the battalion commander and the S3 were flying overhead in command and control helicopters, directing the battle at night by looking at the tracers on the ground.
Oh, my.
Our tracers were red. The enemy tracers were green. and kept giving him orders, which he literally was unable to fulfill, was unable to follow. So they had intense mortar fire, and that's how they lost so many of their men.
Mm-hmm.
So when the, and this was with an NVA, regular NVA unit, North Vietnamese unit, when they left and moved back across the Laotian border, they took all their dead and wounded with them. Now we know, or he knew, that they had killed a substantial number of enemy soldiers, but they took all their bodies with them. And in Vietnam, the metric by which a unit was evaluated was body count.
Yeah, well.
And so, unfortunately, we had no body count. And here a company had been essentially decimated and no enemy body count. So when I came back, I wrote up my report and I turned it into the G3. And he threw it back at me and he said, you know, because I did not hold the company commander responsible for this disaster. And he said, any company commander that fails to, or you know, obey the orders that have been issued to him has to be relieved of command, is to be held responsible. So hold the company commander responsible for this disaster and put in an enemy body count of 456.
These are the stories you only hear about in the movies, and then you find out they are true, aren't they?
I mean, I don't know where that number came from. We had no body count.
Right.
But I was required to rewrite the report.
Isn't that something? Isn't that something? We got a few moments left, Robin. I just something and thank you for your service, sir, because I got to tell you, my father was a World War II veteran. My father-in-law was a Korean veteran. My grandfather was a World War I veteran in the trenches.
Wow.
Yeah, with the Belgian Army of all things. And so I just don't think I have the guts or the makings of what you guys did. At any point in time, did you ever have that feeling like, that's it, I'm not getting out of here?
Yeah, actually, because I was wounded twice during the course of my my tour, and I was ambushed. My unit was ambushed. As I mentioned, we put out ambushes every night, and as we went to our particular ambush location, we were ambushed, and I was wounded, fortunately, not too severely, but I had a lot of blood loss. I got it in the shoulder and in the groin.
Ay-yo.
And hit my head. I lost my helmet, and I hit my head on a rice paddy dike, which are like concrete.
Yeah.
And it knocked me out. And fortunately, my squad leader pulled me back into the tree line. And I was put in the dead pile because I had all this blood all over my shirt and my pants. They thought I was dead. And I woke up and I sat up and I fainted. And nobody, I mean, it's 10 o'clock at night. Nobody saw me.
If somebody did, they would have thought the dead were coming to life.
The second time I woke up, then I moaned and somebody said, hey, he's not dead. Then they came over and put some bandages on me and they stopped the bleeding. But by that time, I lost a lot of blood.
Yeah.
But we couldn't get medevacs in until the next morning. So I lay there on the ground from 10 o'clock at night until 6 the next morning. And I had a long talk with myself evaluating whether or not, if I should have died at that particular point in time, whether or not this was going to be worth it, whether I had contributed anything. And I had a major change of heart at that point in time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something. And I hate to ask you to describe this, but, and I've never had a chance to ask anybody this, the physicality of getting shot, that's gotta be something beyond a punch. I mean, the hit must be, it must be a shock almost in a way, isn't it?
Well, and I wasn't shot. I was hit with shrapnel. And
oh, okay. Well,
in one respect, I was incredibly lucky because we were in a rice paddy that was muddy and wet, and the mortar round went off on one side of the rice paddy dike, which protected me. I caught a piece of shrapnel in my left shoulder because I was trying to direct artillery fire. And then that kind of kicked me over. That's when I lost my helmet. And another round went off in front of me, but it landed in this wet, muddy rice paddy, and it didn't, it exploded down in the ground itself.
Right.
So I got hit with some shrapnel, but because it was in this deep, muddy water, I got mostly got sprayed with mud and muck.
Yeah.
And that's what kicked me back. And that's how I hit my head on the rice paddy. And that was it for me. I was out. I was done with the battle.
So there you go. Sometimes you don't even know it. Hey, you're just, next thing you know, you're conscious. And next thing you know, you're not.
But pure luck on my part.
No kidding. Outstanding. Sir, tell the folks who are listening where they can get your book and what, and maybe you've written some other stuff and you're working on some other things. Tell them all about where they can read them, that kind of thing.
So the best place to get my book, it's available on Amazon, but the best place and the best price is on my website, which is www.robinbartlettauthor.com.
Okay.
And they can just Google Robin Bartlett. It'll come up. Although there's a female actress by the name of Robin Bartlett, not to be confused. But I'm selling the book for $24.95. If you go on Amazon, they're going to charge you $37. It's a hardback book. It's got color photographs. Wow. But my website has a, you can read a free chapter on my website. And I have videos of what it's like to be on a helicopter combat assault.
Wow.
And a little bit about courage under fire. So I think there's a lot to read. I have some blogs there, a lot of photographs. Even if you don't buy the book, they'll find the website to be very robust. I've actually was notified today that I had won the Reader View Award for history, nonfiction history. So I'm very pleased.
Congratulations.
About that.
Excellent. And sorry, the title of the book.
Vietnam Combat,
yep.
Firefights, and Writing History.
And that's exactly what you did.
That's what I did. That's correct.
Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, you're the first combat veteran, Vietnam veteran that I've actually spoke to that talked about it. So it was an eye-opener for me too. And I hope the listeners really dig what you had to say, because it was... harrowing for me. I can just picture that.
I wrote the book primarily as a catharsis, because I wanted to get some of that stuff that happened to me out.
Yeah.
I found as I wrote that it all came, all those memories came back. It's all in your brain. It never goes away.
True.
That was not a very happy experience to sit down and write out these stories. But talking about it on podcasts and in-person appearances has actually been very, very helpful to me.
That's wonderful.
And that's kind of softened the edges a little bit.
Excellent. Outstanding. Robin Bartlett.
I will leave you with one last thought, and that is,
You
mentioned a minute ago, thank you for your service. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with saying thank you for your service to a Vietnam veteran.
Okay.
But if you really want to make an impression on a Vietnam veteran, you say, welcome home.
Welcome home. You're absolutely right. And I knew that and I forgot. It's just been kind of, you hear the thank you for your service. So that's what you get to, right? Yeah. You got it. Yes. That's a welcome home. That's for darn sure. Outstanding. Robin Bartlett, author, Vietnam veteran, combat veteran, and a writer of Vietnam history. Thank you very much for coming on the program. And please, thank folks, pick up that book, because it sounds like a blast.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for 1001 True Stories with me, Brian Trombley. If you think you have a harrowing, scary, strange, frightening, or a life-changing story that happened to you and you'd like to share it on the program, email me at brian@morinstreetmedia.com. That's brian@morinstreetmedia.com. The link is in the show notes. We enjoy reviews as well as you sharing our show with others, so please tell your friends all about it. There will be new stories from more people who have been to the edge and back every Sunday at noon Eastern Time. Until next Sunday, this is 1001 True Stories with Brian Trombley. Everyone's got a story. What's yours?